Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behaviour nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Gene Donaldson. Gene is the founder and principal instructor of the Academy for Dog Trainers, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary in 2019. She's a four-time winner of the Dog Riders Association of America's Maxwell Award. And in 2017, Gene was recruited to create Dog Training 101 for the Great Courses. Born in Montreal, Canada, Gene founded the Montreal Flyball Association and Renaissance Dog Training, the first positive reinforcement-based school and counselling service in the province. Her own dogs and dogs she has trained have earned numerous titles and wins in a variety of dog sports, including OTCH, TDX, HIT, and FDCH. While a student, Jean worked as an adoption counsellor at the Montreal SPCA and later served on its board of directors. Before founding the Academy, Jean did exclusively referral aggression cases for 6 years, and she now lives in Oakland, California with her dog Brian, which she adopted in 2015. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one Gene Donaldson to the show today, who's patiently waiting by. Gene, good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, Ryan. How are you?
Yeah, doing superb. Thank you. And curious as to where the name Brian came from. It reminds me of a cartoon called The Family Guy. Don't know if you've ever seen that.
I've heard of it, but I've not seen it. He was going to be Rhys, R-H-Y-S, which is a Welsh prince who gave Edward I a lot of grief. But when I go into veterinary offices or meet people, they'd say, Rhys, is that Rhys like peanut butter cups? Do you mean Rhys? You mean this? And people, so I switched it to one of his middle names that I assumed everybody could pronounce and spell. So he became Brian.
So nothing to do with white dog on Family Guy. Okay.
Unfortunately, no.
I think it's called Brian anyway. My wife's a big fan. I don't watch a significant amount. But we're getting distracted, and Gene and I discussed it. We weren't going to do this in this episode. So let's just dive straight into it, Gene. Can you tell everyone listening a little bit about your early days? Young Gene Donaldson, where did you get started? Where did you first learn about positive reinforcement animal training? Can you tell us a story and share some more stories about some of the animals you worked with at that time?
Wow. So we're now talking about the mid-1980s. I was doing competitive obedience. At that time, it was all done with aversives. And I was also studying experimental and comparative psychology in school and learning about operant and classical conditioning. And there was a really big disconnect between what I was learning in school and what the obedience club and the seminars were sort of teaching us to do. And it just didn't sit right. And I was never very comfortable using aversives. And so I started to experiment, but there wasn't much in the way of technology then. Finally, I sort of just did it on my own, but I was not fitting in well with my obedience club. You know, I would try to teach the classes that I was assigned to teach, bringing in some positive reinforcement. And it just, I mean, the politics of obedience clubs is such that it just didn't work. So I ended up going off on my own, opening my own school, and then gradually started migrating towards pet dog training because that seemed to be where the need was. And the interesting thing is you can do competitive dog sports, which I did tons of, and it really doesn't prepare you for pet dog training, but that was the career path then. There wasn't sort of, you know, there wasn't academies like we have and others have. There was just, if you rack up enough titles in enough sports on dogs, suddenly you're qualified to counsel about house training or about object guarding. And in fact, they're completely different. And so I had to kind of find my way in pet dog training. And then when I worked at the SPCA, it really came home to me that there's such a crushing need there that in fact, dog sports are less critical in terms of do-gooding. So I migrated towards pet dog training and I haven't really competed since the mid 90s in any sport.
And so you're learning about positive reinforcement and operant learning at university. Did you finished your psychology qualification?
That's right. Yeah, I did a degree in music and a degree in science.
Majoring in psychology.
Yeah, it was experimental and comparative. So I think now it would be considered to be cognition, but in those days it was called comparative psych, which is, okay, so which are the various tools do different species have and how do those compare? What kinds of learning tools do they have?
And you saw, young Gene Donaldson saw a disconnect between that information and the information at your local dog obedience club.
Yeah. I'm interested in the history of dog training. So how it sort of, you know, came down the tradition of dog training generation after generation, and then how that collided with the interest in sort of the guts of it. So the operant and classical conditioning, so how does it actually work? And traditional dog training really did not access that to a great degree. It really came down from military training and post-World War II when there was this sort of baby boom and flood of interest in family dog training. And basically they inherited the curriculum from dog sports and from military training, which if you think about it is really not going to, you know, help with somebody with a, you know, if they've got a Shih Tzu or a Cocker Spaniel at home, it's not the way to do. In those days, that, you know, it basically what you would do is heal, tons and tons of healing. And that was a panacea for behavior problems. And when I think back, I think, boy, oh boy, you know, the poor public were not very well served by the dog training profession then, but it's all we knew.
And you wanted to do gooding, as you said. And so how did that go? You mentioned that you tried to run your classes and it didn't really, there were a bit of politics there.
Yeah.
And so you went out on your own. Did you go out on your own going, yeah, gung ho, I know what I'm doing? Or were you just
I went out on my own going, oh, you know, I'm a rule follower, you know, and very risk averse. And it just seemed, you know, fantastically hubristic to think, well, I'm, you know, run a dog school. But I didn't see another way because I was not being permitted to train the way I wanted to train. And so, you know, it had to, you know, I had no other choice. And as I went along, I gained confidence.
And as you're learning this stuff at university and you're looking at the dog club and you're going, okay, disconnect, there's a difference between learning that stuff and applying it. When was the first time you kind of got in front of a dog? Do you remember that? And you went, all right, let's try this stuff that I'm getting in my degree.
I do. So this, now we're back in the late 1970s. My very first dog was a Doberman, which is just very long story there. But first dog was a Doberman and was trained exclusively using aversives. I mean, I was a young child. I was 11, 12 years old. And so I just did as I was told. We marched around the room and jerked on choke collars and so on. Then I ordered this kit. I mean, it sort of came by mail. There was no internet, if you can believe it. But I ordered this kit, which is how to teach your dog tricks. And the kit instructed you how to, you know, teach the dog to do things. And it was using treats. And I had never done it. Julie went sort of to the cupboard and got little treats. And the dog was just like crazy about these treats. And the learning went so very quickly. And And yet, even in spite of that, seeing how effective it was, I still dutifully went back to this club and was marching around and you know, doing obedience with this dog using choke calls. I didn't put two and two together that, well, wait a second, you could train everything this way. So to my great regret, I never, you know, really crossed over until the subsequent dog.
So in the 1970s, who was providing these kits?
Oh, God, I wish I could remember. It was like something, I think I saw it in a magazine. I don't even remember sort of how I found this little thing by mail, which was, I think it was actually a dog IQ test or something, where you're going to tell how clever is your dog. And then one of the ways that you do it is you teach the dog these things, and then you see if the dog can find a treat underneath a blanket and all these things. My dog ended up being very clever, but I imagine that they the way they sold these IQ tests for dogs was they made sure that everybody's dog came out clever. I mean, I think it was a clever dog, but they, you know, it's very reinforcing for owners to think that their particular dog is clever. But at the time, I remember the first book I ever read was a book called Paul Loeb, Loeb's Complete Book of Dog Training. And it was, you know, now looking back now, I mean, it was probably, you know, a lot of rubbish. It was a lot of pack stuff and some really wacky ideas of how to house train dogs. But I read it because there was so little available. There was that book. And then there was a book by Michael Fox. And I read it to the point where the pages were falling out. And that was, you know, all I'd ever read about dog training.
And so this is in the 70s with your Doberman.
Right, that's
so
right.
So you were from the young age, did you say you were 11 or 12?
I was 11, you know, when I got her.
So you were, can I use the word, obsessed? Is obsessed, if you're reading a book to the pages are falling out?
I mean, at the time I didn't think I was ever going to be a dog trainer. I was going to be a musician. But I certainly was fascinated by that book. This guy was, I believe, a Hollywood trainer. So he trained dogs for movies and so on. And I imagine when he was training dogs for movies, probably food training them. I think that is the best way to sort of get behaviors for entertainment dogs. But interestingly, in his book, he didn't, you know, it's kind of a missed opportunity that he didn't devote more of that book to using positive reinforcement to train. He was sort of just passing on his kind of, you know, odd theories about how dogs work. And so sadly, I could have gotten the bug then, but I didn't.
Yeah, the approximations required to push you to the next level, seemingly.
Right, right.
And are you still a musician, Jean?
Not really. I mean, I produce incidental music for my fledgling podcast, but that's about it. I don't practice much.
Is there anything that you think you took away from your study of music that helped you as a dog trainer?
In retrospect, yes, which is the value of repetition. You know, it's a fair amount of rehearsal, that it's not something, it's not sort of, you know, this sort of flash of knowledge, you know, what's the capital of Russia, or, you know, where is the Mississippi River? It is a skill where, you know, you practice and you practice and you practice and you practice and you gradually increase your skill. And that is a better metaphor for dog training than the idea of knowledge, that, you know, people have this idea that the dog is going to, quote, get it, and that there's this flash moment. I mean, certainly there are breakthrough moments. There are moments where you get, you know, bumps up in you know, quality of performance, but it's not sort of transmission of flashes of insight dog training. And interestingly, also with humans, that I think we as trainers, we tend to self-select for having a great appetite for repetition with our animals, that we get it. We can obsessively and you know, repeat and repeat and have great patience with animals. But when it comes to our human clients, I think we tend to stamp them as non-compliant or not very good if they don't instantly get it. And I think in many cases, people need lots of repetitions, especially of ideas, concepts, and skills and so on that are butting up against their existing knowledge. And I think sometimes we have a hard time translating our patience with animals to people.
A musician's patient people, would you say?
Yeah. There's no way to get good at an instrument unless you practice. There's not sort of, you're not born with it. You've got to, even if you have a great native, I never had a great native talent, but even those who do have to practice.
That's awesome. And so you then started your own classes and What happened next?
Then I, you know, a great surprise to me. It was successful. It grew and grew. I came to a point where, I finished school, and then it was at sort of a crossroads of, well, what am I going to do? I thought about going into animal welfare. Am I going to continue plodding on in music? Going to be a writer, or was like, you know, and then anyway, then I, you know, it became clear to me that at my first Ian Dunbar seminar, when he said, I'm going to paraphrase it, that the idea of forcing healing, of forcing a dog to heal, forcing the pattern when he doesn't even want to follow you, is too stupid for words. And it hit me that, you know, I had been doing that for many, many years, which is forcing, compelling healing with choke chains in a dog who didn't even have the first approximation, which is sort of just being in the neighborhood of the handler, and that we're already trying to compel that was just a real revelation. I ended up actually becoming very seriously ill. And one of the great things about becoming ill is you can get great clarity. You get to, you know, sit back and think, okay, so what's important, what matters? And I decided, okay, I'm, you know, if I live, I'm going to be a dog trainer. And that's what happened. So I decided, okay, I'm going to do this full time, whether it's successful or not, that's what I think I'm going to pursue professionally.
Can we ask what happened?
Yeah, I was at this Ian Dunbar seminar, and it was an 8-hour drive from my house, so quite a lot of miles. And I had been sick for a week, sort of vague symptoms. Turned out I had an appendicitis with, I guess, an abnormal presentation where I didn't feel that bad. But by the time of the second day of the seminar, I was unable to get off the floor of my hotel room, and it actually had turned necrotic. It was gangrenous. It had ruptured. It was a huge mess, and I ended up being 5 weeks in hospital because it was a peritonitis and very complicated. And that's what brought me the great, great clarity and made me decide, you know what, I'm going to be a dog trainer. And then I became a dog trainer.
Well, I've never had anyone say that before on the podcast.
Yeah.
Thank you, your gangrenous appendix.
Yeah. Oh, what a, oh, it's a dreadful thing.
Yeah, sorry to make a joke out of it. But so then 5 weeks in hospital, you had time to sit back and
right.
Ask yourself pretty big questions. What's important? What matters? And you mm-hmm. figured out that if you get through this, you're going to be a dog trainer. Mm-hmm. So what happened after that? Were you just moving forward with a fire under
yeah.
you?
Yeah, yeah. I poured it all into the school, really started taking cases, started trying to, you know, puzzle out, go back to my textbooks. You know, I took another course in learning and motivation, and just try to sort of piece it all together and refine what I was doing. So all the class students, all the cases I was doing were all, there wasn't a huge body. I mean, I attended all the seminars that there were, but there was not a course of study. And so I was armed with this, you know, kind of little bits and pieces that you get from books and seminars and conferences. And then the APDT finally came on in 93, I want to say. There was the first APDT conference, so there was that outlet. But again, I mean, there's not sort of a careful vetting of who presents at conferences and seminars. It's just whoever's got ideas or personality that puts bums in seats gets to present. So there was, you know, unevenness. There was some very good information and some very poor information. And at the time, I was still doing a little bit of competing, so I would attend competitive dog seminars. But I was looking at them in a different way. I was quite often these people who reach the very pinnacle of competitive dog sports, they're extremely good, and they are also very selective of the dogs that they use, because they're, you know, it's very, you know, small margin for error to try and beat people out at the top levels. And I was less listening to their explanations, or in fact kind of interested, because often the explanations they put forward for how what they were doing was working probably wasn't how it actually worked. In other words, they're kind of like savants. They were able to do this, but they didn't really understand the underlying philosophy. They were just physically gifted. And so I was trying to sort of, you know, integrate all these different pieces together with what I knew from school, and then work my cases, and you know, it was certainly not a smooth kind of trajectory. And I'm also a numbers geek, so I kept really good track. I mean, I kept records of, okay, so what are outcomes? What did I do? What was the presentation? And so on. And that ended up, you know, over the great expanse of time, accumulating enough data helped me also to try and converge on what kinds of things work, especially for when I ended up doing a lot of fear and regression, because nobody wanted those cases. So there was a lot of need. And okay, so what actually worked, you know, what factors were prognostically significant? How were they predictive of good or poor prognosis? And how could I then leverage that information going forward in for future case selection or prognostication? That's probably too long an answer, wasn't it?
Prognostication and prognostically significant. is this just Gene Donaldson, or is this something? Is this way of thinking something that you think dog trainers need to start doing more, or is it a little bit too analytical for a lot
No, of I don't think that we suffer from an absence of empiricism. I think we suffer from, as a group, I think there are exceptions, but I think we suffer from too much value placed on intuition. There's certainly a lot of, both culturally in the culture at large and in dog training, of how I feel about this case or how I feel about this dog, whether I feel this dog is good or dangerous or what have you, then dictates whether it actually is. And I think it would behoove us to take a step back and think, okay, so, well, why don't we operationalize? What do we mean by, and even something like prognosis? So how are we going to, we have to define it before we can measure. We need to define, what do we mean? And I just came up with, for lack of any other definition, I said, well, if the dog at the 2-year follow-up, if the dog is still in the home, the clients report that they're, quote, happy with the dog. So they self-report happiness or satisfaction, and the problem has not recurred. I've stamped that a good outcome. And if that was not the case, and it was stamped a poor outcome. So I had at least a couple of buckets I could put things in. I think dog trainers in general, we do, for all our talk about criteria and being very contracty about criteria, I think sometimes we don't operationalize things enough, that there's still, we tend to fall back on our intuition, which I think sometimes at our peril.
So put this in your words, and maybe you just did. Is this us using too many labels? Is this us using too many labels as animal trainers?
Yes. I think there is sort of somewhat of the label rather than what the animal is doing. But even, I think even further than that, what's the animal doing? What is significant, we need to sort of tease our feelings out from it. I mean, I'm thinking especially about aggression, because that's what I did a lot of, but I think we tend to get overwrought. You know, if a dog threatens or growls or bites us or other dogs, that we have an evolutionarily derived reaction to that, that we then fail to account for. We fail to sort of say, wow, even as professionals, that tends to freak us out. And we need to think, well, wait a second, I'm being freaked out by something which, were it otherwise derived. So if I had hurt myself in the kitchen zesting a lemon to the same degree of severity that this dog just bit this child, I would be saying, I'd roll my eyes and put a Band-Aid. But when a dog does it, you know, it's very, a lot of drama breaks out. And suddenly it's, should that dog be killed or not, or should we manage? I mean, this must never happen again. Whereas when if you hurt yourself in the kitchen, or if a child hurts himself playing a sport, we take it much more in stride. So I think the standard that we're holding dogs up to is just not tenable.
And so you, for yourself, operationalized prognosis as a human, a client self-reporting happiness.
Yeah.
And a replacement of undesirable behaviors with more desirable behaviors.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the way I actually put it was that the problem had not recurred. So in the case of, if the dog was a food guarder, that the food guarding had not recurred. If the dog was stranger aggressive, that the dog had not growled or threatened or bitten a stranger in the interim since the conclusion of behavior modification. gratification. So, you know, yeah, there's no question it was being defined as the problem had not recurred. But, you know, for me, that was, you know, for better or for worse, that's how I happened to operation. Now, there might very well be better ways of operationalizing that, that, you know, might say, well, you know, now the dog is doing X, you know, if one wants to absolutely define it as a replacement behavior. But as long as it's done, and as long as it's something that can be objectively measured, and certainly, you know, the client's report, as subjective as that is, at least the dog is in the home, the client is not about to relinquish the dog. And that for me was the key thing. The dog is still in the home. They were happy with their pet, and now they had not had a recurrence of the problem. And that for me was just a way of saying, okay, so the intervention that I did, the management, behavior modification, enrichment that I threw at them and that they implemented was successful. That was for me, bam, okay, I'm going to call that one a success.
All right, cool. So let's backtrack a little bit. You got out of hospital, poured all your heart and soul into your school. You were going to obedience trials and classes and listening to what people were saying, watching what was happening. And then you're collecting all of this data about your clients and measuring the success via what you just told us, et cetera. And then bring us how that led you up to now, which 20 years, is it, into the academy. And congratulations on that humongous achievement. That's amazing. Bring us up to speed 2019. What's going on? And where can people go to find out more and get in touch with you, et cetera?
So now the academy, which we ran it for 10 years, it was run as a live program. So it was a 6-week intensive live course where we worked on shelter dogs at the San Francisco SPCA. And then after that 10 years, left and really wanted a longer program or more repetition, more marination kind of in concepts and ideas, more rehearsal, more practice for the students. And that was not going to work as a live program. People won't, at least I didn't think that the market would bear people coming on site anywhere and, you know, upping, you know, leaving their homes and so on for 2 years or 4 years or whatever it was going to be. Anyway, so then we reinvented it as primarily online. And so people now get coached on their practica via video upload. So they upload video and then we send them back comments. So, you know, at 2:33, you did this. At 8:37, the dog did this and this is this. And send them back. They then do another video, send it, and they get, you know, told, you know, what they've done really well, what they might do a little bit better. And that's the process now by which we train practica. And it actually turns out to be really a powerful tool. And if tomorrow I was to try and teach live again, I'd probably still want to use video because of the ability for people to review their videos, look at themselves. I mean, once people get past sort of the rude shock of seeing themselves on video and can separate and look at what they're doing, it's a really powerful teaching tool. And so now the Academy is, it's strictly done that way. And we're a little different from some of the other schools. We're a little choosier. We don't take all comers. It's smaller, we're really trying to train people who are going to be fully equipped to do all case types. And so they do this program. It takes 2 years, and then there's supervised practice, and you know we do a lot of case support. So it's a bigger commitment, and we're looking for, you know, very particular kinds of people who we think are well suited to the program.
Yeah, that's. Is there many other programs out there, you know, that are 2 years long running online?
I don't know if there are any other dog training. I mean, certainly people could do. I mean, one could do a degree either in psychology or in animal behavior, do a 4-year degree. I think that would be the best comparison. The other programs out there, to my understanding, are shorter and sort of more. They are trying to cover things a little bit less comprehensively, I think, than we do.
And so if you're a listener of this show and you think that the Academy might be something you would like to find more information out about, where would people go to do that?
The place to start would be our website, which is academyfordogtrainers.com.
Awesome. And we will link to all of this in the show notes, so you as a listener can easily navigate there or chuck that what Jen just said into you, URL bar or Google, and you'll land there as well. But let's move on. I want to say thank you to you, Jen, for sharing all of that. We call that part of the show hearing about people's behavioral odysseys. So thank you very much. Moving forward, though, I'd like to really talk about something you mentioned to me when we caught up a few weeks ago that you would like to leverage this opportunity to discuss.
Yeah.
And this is burnout. In your words, Jen, what is burnout and how does it affect us as animal trainers?
Burnout is sort of, sometimes it can sneak up on people and it can be confused with depression, anxiety, other psychiatric disorders. But in the case of burnout, my understanding is that it's specific to a job that one gets over, worn out, tired, unable to take joy, to be feel at all nourished or replenished by one's job. And sometimes it's a function of the difficulty of the job. Sometimes it's an absence of good self-care. My understanding of that is that it's quite endemic in our profession. And I think a little bit under-recognized that dog trainers, there's self-selection for a strong empathy with dogs. And dogs in our society are less valued. We also are sometimes ill-prepared to do our jobs. And so we go in, we're expected to make things better. We suffer then what's called vicarious trauma. So if the dog is being harmed or their quality of life is poor, they're being badly trained or their lives are under-enriched, we identify with the dog and it really hurts us. It hurts us when cases go south. So if the dog ends up euthanized or relegated to a chain in a yard or just has a poor quality of life. And we also are party to and see the terrible crisis of homeless dogs and their lot and all of that. I think we take in and being sometimes unable to process that and feeling simultaneously depressed and sad about it, traumatized in some cases, and unable to sort of and feeling overwhelmed. In some cases, we feel responsible that we have not done enough, or we've not helped, or we could be saving them all. And I think all of that together is a recipe for both what the experts call compassion fatigue, which I think is sort of the junior cousin of burnout, where you're not quite just unable to perform your job anymore, but you're just feeling like you know it's all too much, and you're limping along. And I think that it's certainly become recognized in veterinarians because they suffer a lot of the same kinds of issues of vicarious trauma and the expectations of what they're supposed to do. But in dog trainers, it's not been studied the way it has been in veterinarians. It's not been studied the way it has been in shelter workers. But I think we're a comparable population, and it worries me because as much as we try to train our practitioners, I mean, we pour a lot into making sure at the academy that people graduate with the ability to do cases. All of that is for naught if that person then burns out and is emotionally unable to do the job. We've lost a good soldier in the fight for dog welfare. And so one of the things that we try really hard to do is make sure that we provide support, not just sort of academic and case support, but we provide emotional support, help with self-care, the self-monitoring for compassion fatigue, to make sure that people have, satisfying, joyful careers in spite of the challenges of working with dogs. And I think it's quite possible, but I don't think it happens automatically because, there are a lot of challenges.
We need to make sure that people have satisfying, joyful careers in spite of the challenges. Jen, can you tell us, have you, in your personal experience, got to this point? Do you think you've reached burnout yourself?
Yes, I do. I do think I've many times been, sort of walking that edge, and of course ended up availing myself of resources of getting, myself back on track. And now I'm much more mindful of making sure that my workload is divided. I mean, some of the things are tougher, but also there's some things that, if they're your favorite things. So for instance, we just started up a podcast, and it's something that I, it's it's a project which I both think is good, and eventually there'll be episodes for public. At the moment, it's strictly in within the academy that we're releasing. But it's something that I find interesting. It's a different task. It's a different part of your brain. It's you get to chat with people, just like I'm chatting with you now. It's a different activity, and so you know, populating your work day with tasks, some of them which are tough. I mean, I coach cases every day of students and grads, and some of that can be challenging. I take the odd case myself, and I tend to take cases that are rough because they're just people who've reached the end of the line, and those can be taxing. And so it's good to also have not only activities outside of work that you do that you just learn over time, or things that fill you up, but also parts of your job that are just parts that also are more nourishing. And I find the podcast to be an interesting challenge. We were talking before about getting into the editing, getting into the technical parts, and it's just a whole different thing, and it can sort of renew your energy.
So my hypothesis is, and I might be completely wrong, of the thousands of people from around the world that listen to the show, there's some people that are tuning in specifically right now because they might be resonating with some of the things you're saying. So I'm going to try to pull out some of the ideas and potential, I'm going to use the word solutions at this point, for people in that position. One of them was finding a community, finding a good supporting community. So in your words, what do you have to say to people that might be in that position who don't feel like they have a good supporting community? What are the next steps for them, and what do they have to look for? What makes a good supporting community for someone that might be feeling some of the things you've just talked about?
I mean, if their first step is that they're aware that if any communities that they're in are not supportive, or making them feel dragged down, or making them feel traumatized, or making them feel unheard, making them feel like they're less than, any of those things are symptoms. And if they've identified that, that's a very good first step. And if they then need to seek and have as the standard, they need to set the bar at when you're interacting with colleagues, or if you're in a community, that you should feel uplifted, you should feel supported, you should feel high, you should feel like people care about you, that people care about your well-being and your career, that they empathize when you've had a bad day or a case that didn't go well, or you've had a triumph, something that's gone well, that their people are going to be there, they're going to celebrate with you, and you know where to find that is tough. I mean, certainly the internet is a great resource, but can also be a source of, there can be some real harshness on the internet, where people can be there with their own agendas, and sometimes people can be, you know, bullied or just made to feel unimportant or you know, kind of, you know, trampled on. You know, they it can be really tough. And one of the things that we do is and that's partly why we screen so carefully in the academy. It's not just that people are academically able to do the curriculum or have a sufficient dog resume or behavior resume, but it's also that they've got the personality that, one, they're going to be a fit for our culture, which is supportive. We value humor. We value very good, tight, familial relationships. And I know that I've had the opportunity to sample your community, and it's the same thing, where people are encouraged to behave in a supportive manner, and if they don't, then that's going to be, you know, there's a good Leviathan there to make sure that it's not this kind of Wild West that you see on some social media platforms, where people can feel free to be nasty and mean to one another. I think that's really important. So, you know, I think it does boil down to, when somebody's vetting a community, to make sure that it is one, is how do you feel? Does it make you feel better, or does it make you feel worse when you go there with your triumph, or you go there with a problem, or you go there with a technical, or you're feeling down? How do you come away? Do you come away feeling better? Do you come away feeling worse? And it's a good barometer of whether it's a good community.
Yeah, I like that. Sounds logical, sounds reasonable, sounds like it would benefit everyone. Mm-hmm. Some of the other things you mentioned there were having activities outside of work, finding the stuff that inside your own set of tasks that you have to do to complete your job that you find rewarding. Can you share some, you talked about the podcast then. Was there a time where you feel like you didn't have that? Well, actually, let's change the question. It kind of makes me think about when people say you got to find balance. And I've always kind of had challenges with that myself, because I feel like I don't really believe that you can get balance. But is that kind of where you're going with that, trying to find balance? Is that a way of framing it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you hear about sort of in the literature on self-care, you know, things like work-life balance. And some people, their particular, how they feel good is that it's, you know, they put huge amounts of themselves into their work, and not a lot is taken out of them. And for them, their quote unquote balance might be that they are primarily doing their work. But for other people, it might be that they need to get away from work. It might be that they need to get to nature. It might be they need quiet time. Maybe they need just other tasks. You know, I think people are very diverse. And for them, it just whatever makes you get up in the morning and feel like your quality of life is good, you are able to do your work, you're enjoying enough of your work, and your quality of life is good. I mean, you know, we, as much as we are very concerned about the welfare of dogs, which I think is tremendous, you know, are dogs enriched? Do they feel safe? Are their basic behavioral needs being met? You know, we could take that exact same lens and turn it around on ourselves. Do you feel like your life is enriched? Do you feel safe? Do you feel happy? Are your basics, you know, square meals every day? Is your sleep good? Is your, you know, are your relationships healthy, and so on? That we can do the exact same thing. And I, you know, I think I invite dog trainers to remember that however much the case in front of you that you know, might be driving you crazy, it's really important that 10 years from now, 20 years from now, that you're around. Because if you, you know, if this case is a sinking ship, and you go down with this ship in any way, then there's how many hundreds or thousands of dogs and families in your future are now without you. There's still a critical shortage of competent dog trainers out there, and every good competent dog trainer that we lose to burnout represents scores, hundreds, possibly thousands of dogs in the future that are not going to be well served. And so, if for no other reason, consider yourself a valuable resource, and take good care of yourself, because we're not, you know, nobody is expendable here.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought, because I guess it's not just the dogs and families that individual would help, but it's the people that family would then go talk to and say, look what we've done, and all of those ripples that...
Quite right, yep.
We like the word ripples here.
And all their future dogs.
And all their future dogs, and their kids' friends, and then their teachers. Yep. And we could go on and on. Let's create a list of five things, and we can just go over the other three quickly if you want. I've got two so far. If you think that you're identifying or resonating with some of the descriptions that Jean offered with regards to what burnout might look like, you can go and find, number one, you can go find a community, a supportive community that makes you feel good. Number two is you can just do a bit of a checklist, a bit of a audit on your own activities, what makes you feel good, what potentially doesn't make you feel so good. Let's come up with three more quick. Three more things people can do.
I love that idea of an audit, doing an audit on yourself. Fantastic. I mean, I would, self-care. So, you know, are you eating healthy? Are you getting enough exercise? Is your sleep good? Next thing would be, I think that most people, it's good to have one thing that's outside of dogs. Even if you think that, boy, you know, dogs or your job or behavior is doing everything for you, I think I personally would encourage people, have like an interest or two that is completely different. If for no other reason that sometimes, you know, if you get outside something, it can bring you fresh insight into what you're doing. It's almost like, you know, stepping outside. So I would say to people, you know, try and, you know, find what you're doing. And then we need one more, don't we? Time with your own dogs. That make sure that in the service of, and this is in particular to dog trainers, in the service of your client's dogs, that your own dogs are not getting neglected, because that can be a source of guilt, and it can be such a source of joy that, you know, the dogs that you live with, make sure that you have quality time with them. That, you know, even if it means, like, one thing I do is, because I don't train my dog. So I do things like I'll enroll in a tricks class with him because then I've got homework to do and it forces me to train my dog. And I think that's really helpful. I mean, that kind of structure can be good. So, I mean, it can even be like a bunch of academy people, they all enrolled in sort of an online course to learn certain kinds of things. Just something like that so that you're not neglecting your own dogs.
I'm doing more of that in 2019, doing more online courses. I'm doing more online courses so that I have accountability to spend time with my own dogs. And you know, Animal Training Academy's got to a point where that facilitates I can still have bread on the table and run everything else and create all the other ripples we're creating. So list of five things. Find a community. I'm going to call number two, do your self-audit. Number three, self-care.
Yeah, basics. Make sure your basics are in order.
Number four, from your self-audit, add in there something that's completely unrelated to dog training, animal training, behavior. All the behavior nerds are going, what? There's other stuff in the world?
There is. Yeah, binge watch Game of Thrones. It's all about behavior there too.
I'm good at that. And number five is spend some time with your own dogs, potentially enroll in learning opportunities outside of your current circle so that you can have accountability for spending time with your own dogs. And who doesn't want that?
Yep.
All the behavior nerds around the world are going, yes, let's do that. Right. Hey, thank you so much for that, G. We're going to move on to something we kind of, I feel, started to touch on earlier in this episode, and that is what you call FOD.
FOD, fear of dogs.
So
yes.
Once again, in your words, G, what is FOD and where do you see this happening?
Well, I've got two, I think, explanations. One is sort of, I'm going to embed it in an example. So many years ago, when I first started at the San Francisco SPCA, we brought in an expert who was an expert on behavior evaluations or so-called temperament testing in dogs to upgrade the shelter's ability to do this, to evaluate dogs for whether they were going to be, you know, successful behaviorally in their homes. And this expert came and showed videos. And one of the videos was, a 20-pound or so Cocker Spaniel who was guarding its food dish and growled, snarled, and snapped when you'd approach the food dish. And this was put up. And I remember seeing this example and thinking, oh, okay, so, you know, it's a, under 30-pound dog. It's got protracted warnings. It's a very easy to solve problem. This is going to be about behavior modification, or perhaps they've got a more efficient way than I do of solving this. But it was put forward as an example of, oh my God, we flushed out this incredibly dangerous dog that's going to one day, quote unquote, kill someone, and is this extremely dramatic and dangerous, and we should all be getting chills from how dramatic this is. And and there was certainly that feeling in the room. The professional was putting that forward as, you know, this is an extremely big deal. And of course, this dog is a euthanasia. And I remember, thinking, well, wait a second. This is just an eminently solvable problem with, you know, very good prognosis, easy to solve, tends not to recur. So I had the sense of, boy, there's a collision of the emotional reaction, the intuitive sense of how big a deal this was. And I hadn't sort of labeled it FOD at that time, but in retrospect, that's an example of FOD, is that we tend to, you know, overreact to dogs aggressing against dogs, but especially when they aggress against humans, versus comparable hazards in daily life. So there's that. But I think where it comes from, my guess is that we evolved as prey items. So at one point in our history, we were primates, and animals with pointy teeth naturally elicit a greater panic reaction than do chef's knives or motor vehicles or Windex in the home, things which actually objectively are much more likely to harm and kill us. And we don't question, we don't interrogate this intuitive sense that we have that boy, whatever happens, you know, no dog must ever bite any person. And if they do, it's a death sentence. And what, you know, essentially amounts to arguing in dog culture, you know, which is, you know, growling, snarling, snapping, or biting with attenuated force where there's insignificant injury, that we actually think dogs should be executed for arguing. And it's a funny thing. If you think about other species, even if you compare them, one of your species is birds, is it not?
Yeah, so, love birds, bird-nid.
Yeah, right. And so, if a parrot bites somebody, or if you get a scratch, oh my God, this parrot must immediately die. People who ride horses get thrown from horses. The horse stands on them. The horse bites them. People who have cats, the cat bites them. If you have a hamster, the hamster bites you. I mean, you know, we have this sort of understanding, and we sort of, sports and animals and so on are going to hurt us. But when it comes to dogs, all that goes out the window. And dogs are held to a standard which is completely unrealistic. And it at its core is this very primitive kind of fear, the same kind of fear that we have of things such as spiders and snakes or heights, or enclosed spaces, which is evolutionarily derived that dogs are extremely dangerous. And I think it's natural, and we think, well, isn't that interesting? But when it's in a professional, so somebody who's in a position of authority, and they fail to recognize that they, like most people, have fear of dogs, and they then buy into their own intuition, and then proceed to teach and instruct and do cases on the basis of, oh my God, this is a huge deal. I think sometimes it can really be a problem. We have to think about this and that perhaps, although of course we're going to treat dogs who have aggression, of course, but might we have more objective barometers for what we're going to label as dangerous and severe and so on, rather than one big basket, one bucket where any dog who behaves aggressively is immediately quote unquote dangerous or must, be in some cases killed. And I think that's something that we need to question. And part of it means acknowledging that, isn't it interesting that I have an emotional reaction to when dogs inflict injury, mine or might inflict injury, versus when I hurt myself with a cheese grater in the kitchen.
So everyone listening to this that works, we're all species, specifically dogs or FOD, but we might call it FOB, fear of birds.
FOB, like one of those things that holds keys, isn't it?
FOB is a derogatory word here in New Zealand, actually. I don't want to go into details in this podcast what it means. Ask me after the episode.
Okay.
And I'll tell you. So people, though, that might – we mentioned that idea of cutting yourself potentially with a knife when you're cutting a lemon or grating some cheese in the kitchen, and having an injury versus being bitten by a dog, and how we react differently to those two situations. So for people that are listening to this and have clients, or we're dealing with FOB, we work in a consultancy job in zoos, or we work within a team with keepers, how does this affect us with regards to how we monitor our own behavior and how we behave? What steps can we take to firstly catch that moment where we go from doing a functional assessment or whatever other means we're going to use to analytically look at the situation? And then how can we additionally look at how our clients, our keepers, our whatever person we're training, our learners, how they're additionally also expressing themselves based on their emotions, based on the situation? What are the steps that we can take in that situation?
That's a great question, and it's a tough one. I think for ourselves, we need to think about prognosis estimating. And so in the case of an aggression case, one of the factors that we do care about is we do not want there to be future injury. We don't want anybody to be badly hurt. And so one thing is to think about, using hyperbole. So sometimes people say, this dog is one day going to kill somebody. Well, let's think about that. Let's use our rational mind. So in the US, every year there's on the order of between 25, 30, 35, maybe people a year killed by dogs. Tends to be the elderly or the very young or two dogs. So very rarely is an able-bodied adult killed by a dog. Now, if you think about the incidents, the exposure, there's 300 odd or 360, I don't know how many million people people in this country, an estimated 50 or 60 or 80, we don't even know, million dogs. We live in close contact with them, so we have tons and tons of exposure to dogs. For there to be that many fatalities a year, to get anything that's close to a comparable number, we have to look at something like death by lightning strike, okay, which is it's the very cliche of a rare event. And we're not even talking about lightning strikes, period. We're talking about death by lightning strikes, for which there are three times as many death by lightning strike in the U.S. every year as there are deaths by dogs. So for somebody to have a dog in front of them and to pull out and to say, this is one of the ones that's going to be in that tiny number, that vanishingly small number that's going to one day kill somebody, is so incredibly unlikely that this dog is one of those. And so we need to start thinking about that. No, dogs are fantastically safe, in fact. The other thing is that dogs tend to be relatively stable in the degree of injury which they inflict. So if a dog has bitten you, you approach him when he's got a bone and he bites you to the tune of what we would call a Dunbar level 3, which is a shallow puncture or laceration. The likelihood is if he bites you next week or next year, you're going to get a comparable level of injury. And then we think about, okay, so, you know, what's the upshot of that? How seriously should we take that? And of course, we're going to solve it. But do we need to, you know, go crazy and, you know, lose our emotions? And what do we need to inform the client? People need to know, you know, is this something that's going to, is this a slippery slope to mayhem and murder or not? It's rather like if you and I finish the podcast and then have an argument, is that then predictive of one of us in the next 10 years committing aggravated assault or murder? The fact that we have argued, you know, and you could certainly backtrack. So if you look at people who have committed murder, you could say, well, look, as younger people, they all committed arguing. Therefore, arguing predicts assault or murder. But it doesn't work that way because you have to look at the population of people who argue, and most of us do not go on to commit anything serious. And so all these things can help us to keep our brains in our heads, not lose our emotions. And then we can also help clients who are going to also experience a very emotional reaction, and not just because of fear of dogs, but also there's a sense of betrayal, that this sort of sense of, well, I've provided all these services. I give this dog love and food and care, and in return, he has bitten me. So there's a sense of sort of, lack of gratitude. But when you explain it to clients, says, but wait a second, you know, you love your spouse and you love your children, but you and your friends, and you might argue, it doesn't mean that relationship is destroyed. Everybody argues, and so do dogs. And that can help people to sort of, you know, understand a little bit and then be willing to do the behavior modification rather than thinking that their dog is somehow now gone into the category of axe murderer because he's growled at the food dish.
I haven't heard the axe murderer put on a dog.
Yeah, I mean, it really is helpful. One of the things that we repeat is everybody argues and so do dogs.
So this idea of prognosis estimating, is that what you called it?
Yes.
We used to talk about this with crocodiles when we used to educate people about crocodiles.
Crocodile prognosis estimating. Oh, my.
I don't know, I'm going to repeat this now on this episode because I think it's relevant to what we're talking about. But I'm also going to acknowledge that my fact-finding at the time when I was presenting shows isn't at the level that I'd like it to have been. So the complete accuracy of the information, you know, take it as you will. But we used to tell people that the most dangerous animal by deaths per year in Australia is a horse. They kill the most amount of people. And lightning strikes, falling coconuts. And I think the top killer of people, those like random little event type deaths, was falling vending machines.
No.
Once again, maybe not.
So coconuts worse than crocodiles then?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the amount of deaths from crocodiles in Australia per year is pretty slim.
And yet there's FOC.
There is major FOC.
Yeah.
And it's such an easy one to avoid if you don't stand by a river in certain parts of Australia.
Right.
And so it's our job then to, because, you know, my wife is scared of spiders. And then I've been unsuccessful in my rational explanation of, I love spiders personally, and she just thinks I'm wacky. Rational explanation of why there's not fear, why there doesn't need to be fear there. Although I haven't done a prognosis estimating exercise with her. I'll try that next. I'll report back to you how that goes. but our job is to train ourselves to be more emotionally intelligent than our clients, in so much as we're dealing with emotions over rational thinking. Is that a way of putting it?
Yeah, and to recognize how tough it is. Like you said, you've had a tough time, denting your wife's fear of spiders. That's very, very tough. And so if we acknowledge the difficulty, then we think, okay, it's going to take a lot of repetition. The other thing with fear, I mean, fear is one of those things that moves slowly. You can't go faster than the subject can bear. And so if you wanted to desensitize your wife to spiders, it would be a long, protracted, technical process of doing so. I think with dogs, we sometimes have a slightly easier time if we can remind people of the bond that they have with their dog, and say we can never guarantee behavior, but we can say this is the likely extent of how much this dog will hurt you. Spiders, on the other hand, see, I have fear of spiders too, and I think, well, the next one could be, poisonous, could actually kill you. Death by spider, I don't know what the numbers are, but spiders do kill us. Objectively, spiders are technically dangerous. Now, I might be sort of, I have FOS, and so I'm buying into my FOS hugely here. It's a prime example of buying into one's fears.
So keep your ears peeled for Gene Donaldson, episode number 2, where we do FOS. A prognosis estimation of FOS. I like the fear of crocodile.
Yeah.
Say that acronym. Well,
they actually eat it. I mean, they eat us. I'm not gonna pronounce that acronym, but the idea of being killed and consumed, the dread factor there is huge.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, they grab you.
A snack.
They grab you. They drag you in. They do a death roll on you underwater.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's so awful.
Yeah, it is pretty severe. And just want to acknowledge the, anyone who's listening who doesn't know, actually anyone who's been affected by that, we're not making light out of that.
No, we don't want to make light of that at all.
It's absolutely tragic when it happens. And it does happen. Yeah. Hey, we're going to unfortunately... We're not going to unfortunately say thank you, because I was about to say that. We're going to fortunately say thank you, and then we're going to unfortunately head to our last question for this episode, Gene. We've been on a journey today. We started back with 11-year-old Gene in the 70s, getting her mail order treat package from her magazine, and she brought us up to 2019 with the Academy for Dog Trainers, 20 years now, and talked about some of the most relevant things that are affecting our industry at the moment. I'm going to talk about a few more, though. For our last question, Gene, I'd like you now to take us full circle and take us into the future. What do you really want to see happen in the next 5 to 10 years in the dog and animal training world?
My hope, and I think it's something that's realistic, is that there's going to be regulation of dog trainers. I don't know if you've got in New Zealand Consumer Reports or consumer protection magazines or podcasts, or there is that sort of movement. And in this country, there's a magazine and a very well-known entity where they do things like they test products, they test supplements. So, if you purchase alpha lipoic acid, they'll test whether the substance is in there, and is it in there to the dosage that's indicated on the bottle. They try to protect the public from misrepresentation of how many decibels your new dishwasher is going to whether your new little miniature food processor can it handle nutmeg and so on. So they get very granular about that kind of things, and yet Consumer Reports has never blown the lid off dog training, in spite of our FOD that we've just been talking about and our love of dogs. Dog trainers are largely given a pass. It's sort of assumed that dog trainers are well-meaning. It's assumed that we're in possession of magical powers, and so on. And yet you hear reports all the time. There was one in the news just last week, a company by the name of Sit means sit. And if you think about it, if you embed coercion in the name of your company that might be bad news, that a dog was really badly injured. And we hear these news reports, and yet there has not yet been the, hey, wait a second, what's with dog training? How come this is, you know, like aircraft maintenance is very carefully regulated. Dogs are ubiquitous. We really care about when they injure us. And why has there not been, a real careful examination? So I think that, you know, there's been some push to regulate dog training and regulate the education of dog trainers. We're striving by our own, you know, voluntarily to have high standards, but we're not obligated to. So the academy, we don't have a required curriculum that we have to teach people. We don't have required course of study, required competence exams. All the certifications are optional and so on. And then in terms of consumer protection, I'm waiting for the lawsuit where somebody says, hey, wait a second, my dog is now fearful and injured by some sort of, you know, shock collar, by the use of positive punishment or negative reinforcement. And they're going to get a lawyer and say, why wasn't I told that I could do this with chicken? How come I wasn't informed of the risks? We're very big on informed consent in this country. We have to sign away before a dental hygienist can clean our teeth. How come it is that dog trainers are not required to say in a transparent, concrete manner how they plan to motivate the client's animal? What are the risks involved? And what are the alternatives? And are there any less invasive alternatives? How come we're not required to inform people about the use of aversive stimuli, negative reinforcement and positive punishment? Why are we not required to inform people of the risks? Why are we not required to say to people, well, there's less invasive means, we can use positive reinforcement, negative punishment, and that's how this works, and that's how this works. Why is that not happening? And I think probably in the next 5 to 10 years, that's going to happen. There are some jurisdictions, you know, places like Iceland and Scandinavia and so on. The UK is starting to, and in Canada, there's one province that is verging on having mandatory certification and licensing of dog trainers. And that's something that I hope happens. And of course, it's going to be, you know, difficult. These things always are, but it needs to happen. And I think it's going to happen soon.
I'd love to see the consumer protection study. We have the same thing. We have a very similar thing here in New Zealand.
So anybody can be an animal trainer. They don't have any requirements.
Yeah, I was talking about the consumer protection, like, organization that puts out information. But yes, additionally, there's no requirements to be a dog trainer at the moment. But it's something that a significant amount of podcast guests have incorporated into their answer to that question. So it would seem that a large segment of our community who are privileged with the role of teaching others, that we're all thinking similar things from different industries as well, not just dog industry, but it's the same in the zoo industry, horse industry. So lots of different industries.
Yeah, this sort of self-proclamation, you know, I am, and you hang out a shingle and just do it. I mean, that's just no good.
Yeah, maybe there'll be an animal training general certification one day.
Yeah.
That does, unfortunately, now bring us to the end. Thank you for sharing with us that vision for the future. We here at Animal Training Academy have a mission to just help as many animals as we can by sharing information like the information in this podcast and connecting trainers from all over the world. So thank you for sharing that so that we can achieve our mission here at Animal Training Academy. Just before we do officially wrap up, Jen, can you just remind everyone where they can go to find out more about you, about the Academy, and get in touch?
So the Academy is academyfordogtrainers.com. And for people who are just having difficulty with their pets, there is, via the great courses, there's a course called Dog Training 101, which is for people who don't want to become dog trainers, but are just looking for help with their pets. And I do want to thank you, Ryan, for doing the fantastic work that you're doing. We need more like you in this world.
We need more podcasts out in general circulation, Gene. Hey, we'll link to all of that stuff in the show notes, and thank you for those very kind words there as well. Gene, this has been so much fun from myself and on behalf of everyone who listens to this episode and all of the dogs and animals and crocodiles and birds around the world, thank you for taking the time to come and hang out with us here at Animal Training Academy. It's really appreciated.
My pleasure.
Everyone listening out there, we of course really appreciate you tuning in today as well. If you have enjoyed this episode and you are interested in carrying on the conversation about burnout, FOD, working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com, click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing. Subscribing is the Netflix social media platform for behavior nerds. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again to Gene and everyone so much for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.